David Eagle's Blog, read by David Eagle. Tuesday, February the 3rd, 2015. King Gong Revisited, Part 2. This time round, I was feeling much more prepared for the King Gong competition at Manchester's Comedy Store. This would be my fourth stand-up performance. I wrote about my first and second stand-up spots in yesterday's blog post. My third stand-up gig was last October at another comedy club in London. This time, there was actually an audience, and the compere was funny and friendly. My 5 minutes seemed to go down well. I was less nervous, delivered things with much more confidence, slowed down a bit, and even interacted with the audience. However, this was not a King Gong night, and so the audience got 5 minutes whether they liked it or not. But they did seem to like it, and I went away a lot more confident, having received some positive comments from audience members after the gig. Yesterday I mentioned that my first King Gong performance started off well, but then the audience members began to get a bit impatient when, after 2 minutes, I got to the part of the routine that had a bit of a setup before the joke eventually came. In fairness to the audience, I did go for a whole minute without a single punchline. By the time my London night came along, I'd managed to extend the first bit of my set, making it more joke-heavy for the first 3 minutes, in the hope that this would be time enough to build up a rapport with the audience, in order to then be able to spend more time on the longer setup to the final bit. I also worked on cutting down some of that setup time. This seemed to work well in London, with the first 3 minutes gaining lots of laughs, and the audience remained patient and seemingly attentive for the following 40 seconds of preamble before I eventually gave them a series of payoffs which got good laughs. However, these audience members did not have red cards. How, I wondered, would this material hold up in front of the judge, jury and executioners that make up the King Gong audience? The King Gong nights feature a wide range of people. Last time I talked about one of the performers who I particularly enjoyed called Benji Waterstones, who was one of the contenders for last year's BBC Radio New Comedy Award. February's King Gong show featured another comedian I recognised from last year's BBC Radio New Comedy Awards, called George Lewis, who is very funny and, like Benji, made the full 5 minutes. But in contrast, there were acts who were very much at the other end of the funniness spectrum, including one who, by his own admission, wasn't really an act at all. "I'm not actually a comedian, I'm just doing this for the free tickets." And he really meant it. He more or less just stood there until, eventually, he was gonged off. Surprisingly, though, he did manage to last for 1 minute 32 seconds, which was actually longer than some of the acts who actually had jokes. But does this include me? Let's find out. Yesterday I mentioned that I wanted to try slowing my words down a bit, as last time I tended to race through it due to nerves. Because I am new to performing solo stand-up comedy, I perhaps am not yet fully confident that the laughs will come, and therefore I dare not take too long a pause after a joke in case I receive nothing back but silence from the audience. I've heard a lot of comedians talk about their first few gigs and the ordeal of hearing a silent audience and the sound of their dry lips smacking or their breath rasping loudly over the speakers. And so I suppose I'm choosing a way of combating this, which is to talk quicker and not to leave long pauses so that I don't suffer this ignominy. The problem with this tactic is you don't allow time for the joke to register. A pause is a signal to the audience that you've finished your bit and now it's time for them to respond. Listening to the recording back now, I still think that I need to slow down more and pause for longer. I delivered my first joke, heard the beginnings of a laugh and instantly moved on to the next bit. But my next bit was interrupted by the sound of the laughter crescendoing. People who are at the night might feel that the word crescendoing is a tad over the top, but look, this is my blog and if I want to use pretentious Italian words to describe the audience's reaction to my comedy, then I bloody well will. But semantics aside, I had to stop talking because I realised that people were still laughing. The same thing happened for the second joke. One lady at the front, with a rather loud laugh, responded a few seconds after everyone else. I was pretty sure that I recognised this lady as the person who'd been chatting to the compere just a few minutes earlier, who was from Dundee and had quite a thick Scottish accent. So, knowing that the audience had already been acquainted with this woman, I made a little joke about slowing down so that the lady from Dundee's translator could keep up. Unfortunately, not being able to see the person, I had mistakenly identified the wrong lady, and so the audience were confused as to what the heck I was talking about. I didn't realise this until Isabel, my girlfriend, pointed this out after the set. Still, the audience was seemingly on my side. The jokes were getting a good response, and I was beginning to feel more confident, although I was aware that the 40 seconds of setup were still upon us, and I wasn't sure whether the audience would be in the mood to wait. After 30 seconds of the setup, the first card was held up. "One card!" shouted the compere. Fortunately, this time I realised that it was the compere shouting "one card" and not someone in the audience shouting "wanker," and so I continued, largely unconcerned about it, given that I expected that this part of the act might result in a casualty. Although there were no cries of "wanker," I could nevertheless sense a restlessness throughout parts of the audience. But I had no choice but to continue. I was halfway through the setup. I couldn't just scrap it and move on to something else. So I ploughed on. But then a few people in the audience began vocalising their restlessness. The second card was raised. Despite this, one of the jokes still got a laugh, but it was evident that this was polarising the audience. I tried to continue. The next bit is really painful for me to listen to. The dissenting voices grow louder, and the third card holder raises their card. The gong sounds, and I am dismissed. I made it to 3 minutes 59 seconds. The first 3 minutes were going pretty well, but it seems as if this story, which I still believe is funny and got a good response from the more patient crowd in London, needs a lot of work on it before I'll try and tell it again. After my first King Gong performance, I wrote that folk audiences are happy to wait for 40 seconds for a story to be set up. They do not have the same rapacious appetite for joke after joke that a mainstream comedy audience has. I thought I'd learnt this lesson last time, which is why I attempted to cut down the setup. But I obviously hadn't learnt the lesson fully, and so I'm going to have to stick to the concept of getting to the joke as quickly as possible. Maybe in the future I'll be able to tell more complex stories in front of the King Gong crowds. But for now, I'm going to have to concentrate on jokes rather than anecdotes. When the compere chatted to the chosen card holders, he asked them who their favourite comedians were, and two of the names that came back more than once were Frankie Boyle and Lee Evans. It therefore stands to reason that such people may not be inclined towards more anecdotal-driven comedy, especially when that anecdote is deficient in comedy for at least 40 seconds. Again, like the last time, I lasted the longest out of all the acts who didn't make the full 5 minutes. There were 5 acts who managed to make the full time, so I suppose on this occasion I came 6th. I think there were about 20 acts all in all. So I did better in terms of my personal record, but worse in terms of ranking, as I was 4th last time. So, put that in your spreadsheets, people. I'll definitely be returning to the King Gong in the near future, and I would recommend it as a great night out. You get a chance to see some really good comedians and some complete oddballs. There is an element of jeopardy introduced by the red cards, and it's all expertly held together by the compere, Mick Ferry. I'm going to practice some more other open mic comedy nights, scrapping this irksome anecdote for the time being, and instead concentrating on compiling a solid 5 minutes of comedy from the best bits of both my King Gong performances. In the meantime, there is some exciting Young'uns news around the corner and a new Young'uns podcast to come next week. Plus, it's high time that I made a start on the 3rd pick and mix. Thanks for listening, and I hope you didn't get all restless halfway through and start shouting "wanker." And, of course, we encourage your comments on my blog posts. Most of the time I don't get a chance to read out your comments. I'm quite late in finding them, actually. So I find a lot of people's comments way after I've written the blog, so apologies if I don't reply. But normally I release the podcast quite quick after the blog post, so I don't get a chance to read out the comments for that reason, because the comments haven't been posted yet. But we have a comment, which I shall read, and then I shall read my response to it. Anyway, this is a comment from Phil. I couldn't do this to save my life. I used to want to be a comic, although this was around the time that I used to fancy my mate's big sister and worried about going up to big school. Sometime in my teens, I realised that if you were a comic, some of the audience might not like you, which put me right off. The thought of performing in a gong-based setup when the audience have been positively encouraged not to like you makes me just go cold. Free tickets man must have nerves of steel, and maybe he'll work up a set about not having a set and end up being the next big thing. Yeah, that's interesting, actually, what Phil says, because there's a lot of acts on the circuit, actually, that I've seen doing, like, that kind of thing. The whole thing is about, oh, I'm a bit of a nervous comedian, I've lost me jokes, where are they? That kind of thing. And it's like the whole act is about them not being very good and not having any jokes. And unless that's done very well, the irony is they may think they're being a character, but if they don't have any jokes, then they are essentially a person without jokes. It's like these people obviously haven't got any material, so rather than thinking, oh, I'll tell you what, I won't perform yet because I haven't got any material, they think, oh, well, I'll just perform, admit that I haven't got any material, pretend that I'm a character of a comedian that hasn't got any material, and that'll go down really well. But it doesn't go down well because you're essentially a man with no jokes. So it's interesting point there, Phil, but that does happen quite a lot in the comedy already. I replied to Phil in writing. Formally in writing. That was a spoken reply now, Phil, if you're listening to this. I then replied to Phil in writing. I said, apparently stand-up is one of the three things that people most fear doing, according to various polls that I've read. The other two are apparently skydiving and bungee jumping. Perhaps one day I'll really break the fear barrier and do a stand-up comedy gig while plummeting through the air. Although it might be a little bit risky, especially if the skydiving instructor takes a strong disliking to the material and decides to exercise his right to heckle by disconnecting the harness. I think I'll just stick to a stage setting for now. There we are. So, a lovely extra bit, I'm sure you'll agree there. Feel free to comment, and you can have the privilege of hearing your comment read out by me and maybe even responded to. I mean, my goodness. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back very soon.